Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, June 20th, 2001. In a Creekside room this afternoon is Peter Bankston. Today's session number is BEP-2001-03 and is entitled Nuclear Waste and Politics. What do we know about it? What should we know? Let's listen in.
Glad you could come. I'm Peter Bankston, and a little background about myself, and I'm going to lay out what I hope to accomplish today with you, to give you some background about Hanford. But first, my experience or my jobs here at Hanford, at Holden first. I'm a housekeeper and working part-time as my family's up here for a couple of weeks on vacation, and I volunteered because I think it's important to get information out about the Hanford site, which is located on my artistically incorrect drawing here of the Washington State. In the southeast corner, there's a 560-square-mile site known as the Hanford Nuclear Reservation to most people. Before I go maybe much further, has anybody here heard of Hanford before, maybe the announcements? What's, in a word or two, what would you say, or what? How would you define what you've heard so far? Or what's your impressions of what you've heard about Hanford? Anybody?
Just associated with nuclear stuff.
Nuclear stuff, okay.
Yeah, aren't they having some trouble with leakage into the aquifer, or not?
Yes.
They are.
Leakage, okay. Yeah, there is a massive aquifer that's under the site that flows into the Columbia River, mm-hmm. and there's been contamination verified in the aquifer from okay. Hanford.
Contaminated soil?
Contaminated soils, yes. Yeah, Hanford was originally part of the Manhattan Project in 1942. It was cited for its perfect location as being very remote, and the 560 square miles that was basically identified and possessed by the government and pushed farmers and local residents, few that they were, but pushed them off of that area. They built at 1.9 nuclear reactors to produce plutonium materials or billets, well, like hockey puck size material that was sent off to another facility, another part of the country to produce nuclear weapons. It's said that when those nine nuclear reactors were fully operational, because of the cooling water that was discharged from the ponds and or the nuclear reactors directly into the Columbia River, the temperature of the Columbia River downstream was identified being changed by 2 to 3 degrees. When you think about the Columbia River and how big and how fast the water is that flows, that's a significant impact to that environment. They've identified through isotopes and other contaminants silt behind the at some point behind some of the dams were not in place when they first started operations, but they've identified contamination along the west coast of Washington and Oregon, so the Columbia River has flown some contaminants out there and reached those parts of the ocean shoreline itself. My background a little bit and is that I'm doing housekeeping cleanup here, and I'm promoting and trying to encourage information about cleanup at Hanford, so I don't know sure if there's a direct tie to that or not, but we'll run with it for now. Maybe it's making amends or something for what I do, but my job at Hanford itself for the last 10 years has been in the area of communication, and some people might call that public relations. General communication specialist is what I am, and work for a contractor for the U.S. Department of Energy. And my main task or specialty is public involvement, getting members of the public involved in the decision-making processes that are involved about how to or how clean to clean up Hanford, if you will. Essentially providing information to the public about things that have been for over 40 years were behind basically a curtain of secrecy. When the Manhattan Project started in 42 and 43, a workforce of about 50,000 people didn't know what they were doing. They knew they were doing something in support of World War II, trying to bring an end to the war, but generally they didn't know. Some of the interesting kind of anecdotes about Hanford is that some children thought their daddy worked in a toilet paper factory, because every once in a while he'd bring home a roll of toilet paper in his lunchbox. The thought was is basically during the war times things were short, and so there was extra toilet paper out there, he ran out at home. So, but nobody really knew other than probably a handful of people. Because purpose, again, that I'd like to emphasize that we could accomplish today is talk about what is Hanford, what are some facts associated with it, what are the issues perceived or real, what are the perceptions that people have, and go with kind of the title of today is talk about some of the politics that are associated with the Hanford site. Just a little bit of background. The project that I'm specifically assigned to has been identified not just by the Department of Energy, but by the state of Washington and Oregon, and to some degree the state of Idaho is the biggest and biggest priority and the biggest environmental cleanup project in the country, particularly in the state or in this region. And that has to do with 53 million gallons of high-level waste that's stored in 177 underground tanks. These tanks range from 50,000 gallons to 1 million gallons in size. Of the 53 million gallons, well, there's 53 right now in storage as far as we know, as best as they can measure. They've leaked at least 1 million gallons of the 177 tanks. 67 are believed to, or at least assumed to have leaked. It's very difficult to measure these tanks and the high-level waste. This is extremely hot radioactive waste, and there's a lot of radioactivity and a lot of waste at Hanford itself. The tanks probably possess about 85 to 90% of the radioactivity at Hanford. Hanford has over 60% of the radioactive waste in the country stored either in the soils or in some sort of containers. The practices of the time and during the war effort was to drain the cooling waters from the 9 nuclear reactors along the river, let the water go into these earthen trenches along the Columbia River, settle for a day or two so the heavy elements would settle into toward the bottom, drain or flush the water, radioactive water then into the Columbia River, and like I mentioned earlier, it affected the temperature of the river at one point when those nuclear reactors were running. And during that time, they estimate that over 1 billion gallons of radioactive liquids were dumped into the soils at Hanford. That was not necessarily the high-level waste. It was very radioactive, not to downplay that at all. The project that I'm working on has the highest level of waste. It's identified the highest level of waste to have a half-life of at least 10,000 years. A fraction of that, 53 million gallons, is identified to go to a national repository someday. A lot of people will be willing to bet there never will be one, and that'll probably stay at Hanford forever.
Just out of curiosity, if you were talking million gallons, 50,000 gallon tanks, would this room be about 100,000 gallons? I mean, how big are these tanks?
Well, again, they do range in size. Generally, the tanks, I'll have some pictures and I can show you a video here in a little while. It gives you some perspective. Essentially, the larger tanks are about 45 feet in diameter and about 50 feet high.
That'd be close to 1 million gallons?
That's about a 1 million gallon size tank. There's a demonstration. If anybody has got a better analogy of how to depict it, what or how you store 53 million gallons, one of the classic examples or kind of visuals to try to give you is that if you had a football field 100 yards long, approximately 50 yards wide, you'd have 150, you'd fill that football field and it would be stacked up 150 feet, about 10 stories high of nuclear waste, high level nuclear waste. So, There are other sites around the country that have nuclear waste, high-level nuclear waste specifically. Savannah River in South Carolina, there's waste that's been processed and is in powder form in Idaho and Idaho Falls. Rocky Flats in Colorado, Oak Ridge in Tennessee. For those with high-level waste, Hanford is the only one that does not have a treatment capability for that waste. In Savannah River, they have got basically a vitrification or glass-making facility. Idaho has processed their waste. They're looking for a way to permanently dispose of it. In fact, the governor negotiated by literally closing the borders to any waste being shipped into Idaho, shut the borders to the federal government, which made a lot of newsworthy attention to the fact that there's this waste issue and they have no place to send this waste, and what are you going to do? And so there's a promise from the federal government to ship Idaho's waste off-site by, I think it's 2034. Hanford right now is in the process of well, we have contracts in place. We're trying to get enough funding to build a treatment facility at the site. The treatment facility is 3 times bigger than the biggest treatment facility to make glass, turn high-level waste, for example, into glass. It would be 3 times bigger than anything that exists in the world, and processing at full capacity will take about 30 to 40 years to treat the waste. We're talking a $30 to $40 billion treatment project for the high-level waste specifically. It is a legacy, again, from the Cold War and from World War II. But the loop has never been closed. The priority has always been, and the emphasis was, to build a treatment, to build the nuclear arsenal, if you will, to try to win the Cold War. And the cleanup part was never very sexy or never very interesting. That was always put off as not a funding priority, as not in a sense of urgency associated with that. So that has continued to be the first thing that got cut when the budgets were tough. Right now, we've got two major contractors lined up to start building both the infrastructure to feed a treatment plant and to build a treatment plant, which would take 4 to 5 years to build. It's over the size of the footprint of the facility is over 65 acres. And it took 4 or 5 years to build. It would be estimated by 2018 they'd only process about 10% of the waste. However, the federal budget this is kind of the political part of it, I guess. There has been a federal budget presented by the current administration that would slash the funding for environmental cleanup. Again, they're trying to cut back on taxes, cut back on other issues, and one of the first things in the Department of Energy that's been cut again is the waste management process or treatment facilities, construction and cost for the maintenance of those sites that have waste management issues, cleanup issues. At this point, what we're looking at current funding levels would be a 4 to 6 year delay in building a treatment plant, and we're looking at if the funding isn't recuperated like it's been promised, that we're looking at a 10 to 20 year delay. I mentioned earlier that tanks are leaking or have leaked. We don't know if there's any leaking at this point in time. The tanks that were designed initially were to last 20 years. We're going on over 50 years for some of those tanks. So it's just a matter of time. Stakeholders have described Hanford as having two kinds of tanks, those that have leaked and those that will. And it's a matter of time before single shell tanks start to leak. Right now, since the 70s and 80s, they built double wall tanks. Those have not leaked yet. There's 28 of those. They're 1 million gallons each. We had a scare earlier this year that there might be a crack in one of them, at least in the inner wall, and it hasn't released any contamination. They're still watching that closely, but watching the integrity of these tanks is a priority for the state of Washington. And all the more emphasis on why we need to get a long-term solution. At the current funding proposals by the government, we would be in the business of building more tanks and providing a temporary storage answer as opposed to a permanent solution. When you look at the current technology to retrieve the waste and feed the treatment plant, by the time you would feed all of the waste to new, safer, newer tanks, you'd amazingly spend about the same amount of money as you would if you built a treatment plant. So some of us think this doesn't make a lot of sense. But what it is they're just trying to push off the cost. And every time they push off the cost, because this is the fourth time Hanford has tried to build treatment plants at Hanford, the costs continue to go up. The longer you wait, the more costly it is, more leaks into the soil, no technology to retrieve most of the nuclear radiation that is leaked into the soil. The technology doesn't exist to retrieve it, so it's lost. It's reached the groundwater, the aquifer below the Hanford site. Scientists said that 10, 15 years ago that it would take 100 years for the leaks that happened, the million gallons that have leaked from the tanks, to reach the groundwater. Our environmentalists and state regulators and others said, no, it's going to be quicker than that. And in November 1997, the Department of Energy confirmed that there were tests taken of the aquifer and that the waste from the tanks had reached the groundwater. The tanks are approximately 7 miles from the Columbia River. Estimates are 75 to 100 years until the contamination actually reaches the river. You'll hear on a tape that I'll play here for you in a few minutes, one of the state regulator representatives basically say she believes it's going to be about 25 years before it reaches the Columbia River. So, questions?
What are some of the real health care issues to both humans and to the environment?
Well, in the near term, there's at Hanford, I'm talking about generally the site, you still have 9 reactors and hundreds of support facilities that have been contaminated that sit around the Hanford site. There are trenches and ditches that are, say, fenced off, but critters still can crawl and burrow into them. So there's a constant effort to watch and protect the animals and the other things that happen there. There's been an effort to shut off all water discharges, whether it's clean water or not. The more water you put on there, you have to worry about it driving the contamination further down into the aquifer. So those kind of steps have been taken. In terms of human health, generally the site is closed off to the general public, and or areas have been fenced off where if you walked into it, you'd be exposed to the radiation. Along the river, there are, particularly from contaminants from the trenches, the pits, and or discharge facilities around the nuclear reactors, there are springs or seeps flowing into the river that are hundreds, if not in some cases thousands of times above EPA standards, drinking water standards, for example, is how they generally measure it. And that's a variety of different contaminants. When they were processing and producing plutonium, not only did you have plutonium and uranium bits and pieces in this waste, but you also had processing chemicals of acids and other extremely hazardous waste or chemicals that they mixed with to erode the material down and get what they needed to process. So you've got not only radioactive hazardous material, but you've got chemical hazardous materials as well that are in the soils and or seeping into the river. At this point, they're constantly measuring and monitoring the river. And Richland, the town that I live in, which is downstream, and basically is a government town that was built to support the 50,000+ people that at one point were working 7 days a week, 3 shifts a day to build the Hanford machine. They basically are monitoring that and saying that it's below hazardous. You know, there's no risk to human health for those of us that are drinking the water. And that's partly because of the vast flow of the Columbia River. It dilutes it, and or it settles down and the intake is measured and or they have filtering systems on the water. The amazing thing engineering-wise about the Hanford site is that they were working those 3 shifts 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for about 18 months, and then within 18 months they produced the first nuclear reactor. It went basically from a pilot plant that was built that proved that there was this nuclear fusion reaction that could occur in a secret lab under Chicago University's football stadium. They took that model, that's that scale and made it a full-scale model within 18 months. They were literally designing the engineering pieces to build that facility the night before. It was still hot when they handed it to the workers in the field the next day to go ahead and put that part on the plant. I mean, they were literally making and creating things as fast as they can design and engineer them. I'm talking more than I wanted to. Other questions or comments? Otherwise, I might run this video to see if I can generate. Yes?
This may be answered by the video, but what exactly goes into the treatment process for this waste? You said something about converting it to glass. What happens to it, and how does it become innocuous, or does it?
Well, we will be touching more. I am clearly not a technical expert in terms of what's going on, but essentially what they do is they need to put together a transfer line from these tanks, updated ones. A lot of them are old or antiquated and leak. So they're building new, needing funding for new infrastructure to feed the facility, as well as have that old line up and on, you know, perfect government planning, make sure that they got the infrastructure there at the same time the plant's ready to go. Feed it, they pre-treat the waste, separate it into two different fractions. One basically that's extremely high level that lasts 10,000, has a 10,000 year half-life, which would be, under federal guidelines, have to go to a national repository if it should happen. It's very expensive to pre-treat it to make sure that that fraction is available to go there. The rest, basically 90% of the waste, which is still high level radioactive waste, is sent off into another high level melter. These are huge melters that basically go up to, I can't remember what it says, hundreds, if not 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit, to basically add glass cullet with the waste, heat it up in the melter, and then pour it into stainless steel canisters that are about 2 feet by 15 feet in diameter. Then they're sealed, cooled and sealed, and stored indefinitely on the Hanford site in the facility that they have there.
So you're essentially suspending the radioactivity in an inert form so it can't react?
Correct. These canisters are, there will still be heat coming off of them, but the radioactivity will be contained inside the canisters, by and large, and they will be in that's the whole purpose, to put them in an inert form so it's no longer liquid and or has the access into the environment. Yes?
You know, two things. The anti-ballistic missiles program of the president.
Yes.
Will this not increase the amount of nuclear waste? And secondly, the assumption that we're going to have to build nuclear plants for energy.
Correct. Well, for the cleanup business, those projects are basically a death knell to clean up. The funding, the priorities, again, are going and shifting toward those kind of projects. In some places, well, creating nuclear power plants generally are not also, they can make plants so that they aren't generating plutonium. They're basically, the focus is not for nuclear materials in a way, but generating waste, spent fuel rods, etc., high-level waste that would be sent to the National Repository. The government is about 10 years behind. They were supposed to start shipment, I think almost 10 years ago, to a National Repository, and they still haven't gotten the permits from the state of Nevada. For some reason, they don't want that stuff stored in their state. But right now, the current administration is saying that we need to look at nuclear power as a means of supplementing our energy crisis. There hasn't been a permit for a nuclear power plant for about 20 years, if not longer, just because politically it has, publicly it has been an unacceptable answer. There's an extreme public relations campaign to say that this is something that has been poorly understood and needs to be pursued. My job is to be a facilitator and kind of a neutral person in terms of out there with the public and make sure that the public has an opportunity to meet with the decision makers and make sure that they're hearing the right questions and getting that input. Often what I hear the stakeholders say, I won't necessarily tell you my personal opinion, but what the environmentalists, the state regulatory agencies and others from this region particularly will say is that don't even consider one, shipping more waste around or two, creating more waste until at least you even consider that, until you even have a, you close the loop on how you deal with this. You know how to make it real well, but you haven't figured out how to clean up your mess. And a lot of us, you know, we're taught by our parents that you make a mess, you got to clean it up. Well, the federal government hasn't apparently learned that lesson very well, and there's still this legacy that sits out there and is leaking into the environment, poses risks to this region. And politically, economically, the risk to this region, when you think about access and or the use of the river, the environment, fishing, agriculture, which is basically watered by the Columbia River. I remember about 15 years ago, there was what, in the apple industry, probably cringes to remember, was the Aylar scare, where there was, when you think about it, a very smart public relations campaign dealing with pesticides, something called Aylar, that just happened to be a pesticide that was mostly used for apples. When you think about certain things, what is more precious than the apple? Motherhood and apple pie. When you think, you know, apples in the school lunches, an apple for your teacher, what have you. That created a major public relations situation where the agricultural industry in this area basically was hurting in a major way because of the perception that apples were tainted with poison. What if the perception becomes, because the waters that basically feed the asparagus fields, one of some of the biggest, the apple and the cherry and peach industry in this region, were tainted with radioactive water. Some people might think, hey, irradiated fruit, what a way to go, don't have to worry about bugs. Most people would say, I'm not buying that. I'd rather go someplace else, and would shut down a major economic linchpin for this region. Politically, it has major implications. So I hope I'm kind of getting to where your question was in a very, very roundabout way. But it would, there are, I'm not sure if the nuclear defense system, the EBM system, would necessarily create specifically more waste. It would spend a lot of money on research trying to figure out how to build one that would prevent us from being able to move forward and clean up the past 50 years of experiments that they've been doing with radioactivity and other nuclear military weapons. So I think what I'll do is turn this video on. This video, I'd like to get your input on this, was created by the Department of Energy for the primary purpose of getting information out about it, about particularly the tank project that I'm working with. One of the things that's my job is sometimes isn't very popular, but I feel it's my duty, is to go and tell leaders, you know, you're getting a little too cheerleader-ish, or you're sounding really positive about something that's really not very good, and to tell them to change their tone to be more realistic. One, there's some information here that'll give you some perspective, and if this looks too PR-ish, I apologize. I think it got toned down, believe it or not, from where it came from. It'll give you some visual of what we're talking about.
Within a few miles of the Columbia River in southeast Washington, one of the nation's largest cleanup projects is underway at the Hanford site. 60% of the country's nuclear waste is stored here, 7 miles from the river, in 177 underground tanks. The waste is the result of decades of nuclear materials production for national defense. The The tanks range in size from 50,000 to 1 million gallons. Together, they hold approximately 53 million gallons of radioactive and chemical waste in the form of sludge, salts, and liquid. It's enough waste to fill an area the size of a football field to a height of about 150 feet. 149 of the tanks consist of a single carbon steel shell surrounded by reinforced concrete. Expected to last 20 years, many are now about 50 years old. In the last three decades, 28 newer, safer double shell tanks have been built. These consist of two carbon steel shells surrounded by reinforced concrete. Although no tanks are currently known to be leaking, in the past, nearly a third of the single shell tanks have leaked an estimated 1 million gallons of waste into the soil. There are concerns additional tanks could leak, and contamination could eventually reach the Columbia River. The Department of Energy's Office of River Protection will remove, treat, store, and dispose of the waste. The radioactive material from the tanks will be turned into glass, a process called vitrification. The Office of River Protection already performs waste removal operations at Hanford on a day-to-day basis. To reduce the risk of a future tank leak, all of the pumpable liquid is being moved from the older single-shell tanks to double-shell tanks. To solve a potential problem created by gas building up in double-shell tank SY-101, over 500,000 gallons of waste was removed. The waste level in this tank had been rising for years due to an increase of flammable hydrogen gas. Operators pumped out and diluted the waste, thereby avoiding a potential crisis.
We've made good progress over the last 7 years, stabilizing the tank bombs, reducing near-term risk. Now it's time to move on to the long-term solution for Hanford tank waste. We're preparing to retrieve the waste from the tanks, turn it to glass, and put it away for long-term disposition. That's the ultimate solution to the Hanford tank waste problem.
A 350,000 square foot plant is being designed to turn Hanford's tank waste into glass. The vitrification process has been used on large-scale projects around the world and is a safe, proven technology. Before waste treatment at Hanford can begin, the Office of River Protection will make extensive improvements to the tank storage area to safely move the waste to the vitrification plant. Over time, much of the waste in the tanks has settled into layers. To remove this waste, large mixer pumps will be installed. The 300 horsepower pumps are over five stories tall in order to reach the bottom of the tanks and mix the waste so it can be removed. Transfer pumps will be installed to move the waste out of the tanks. A new network of pipes is also being installed to transport the waste to the vitrification facility for treatment.
It's ecology's and the state's number one issue at Hanford. It is our number one priority to get the retrieval and treatment of the tank waste started. And we can't start that without getting a treatment plant on the ground and going.
On a site next to the tank storage area, a construction force of more than 2,000 workers will build the vitrification plant. Construction of the plant will begin with the largest facility on the site. The pre-treatment building is big enough to cover three football fields. This facility will separate the waste into high-level and low-activity waste streams. Two vitrification facilities, one for each waste stream, will be built to mix the waste with molten glass. Site administration and support facilities will complete the vitrification facility complex. When the tank and waste transfer upgrades are complete and the vitrification facility is built, cleanup can begin. Mixer pumps inside the tanks will blend the waste that is settled into layers. Solids in the tank will be mixed with the liquids and the salts will be dissolved. The waste may also be diluted or heated to avoid plugging the transfer lines. Tank waste is then sampled to make sure it meets the requirements of the vitrification process. Finally, the waste is pumped out of the tank and routed through diversion stations to a main feed line leading to the treatment plant. Inside the pre-treatment building, the waste accumulates in holding tanks. From here, batches of waste will go through a series of steps designed to concentrate and separate it into high-level and low-activity waste streams. This will minimize the amount of highly radioactive waste, which is more expensive to dispose of. In the low-activity waste building, glass-forming materials are mixed with the waste. The mixture is then heated in a melter to about 2100 degrees Fahrenheit. Three melters in the low-activity building are capable of producing about 30 metric tons of glass per day. The molten glass will be poured into large stainless steel containers. The containers will be moved to a cool-down area and sealed. The process for turning high-level waste into glass is similar, but only one melter is needed because there is much less waste to treat. This smaller melter will be capable of producing about 1.5 metric tons of glass per day. The most critical component of this operation is the melter, which is based on technology in service at other facilities in the United States and Europe. A pilot melter testing a proposed Hanford design has performed at a superior level, producing glass at over 150% of its expected production rate. After the sealed high-level canisters are decontaminated and prepared for storage, they will be moved to Hanford's existing canister storage building. The canisters will remain here until a permanent national disposal site is established. The Office of River Protection will dispose of the low-activity waste containers on the Hanford site in underground concrete trenches. During the first phase of cleanup, the Office of River Protection is scheduled to vitrify a minimum of 10% of the waste by volume, or about 25% when measured by radioactivity. That's the equivalent of about 600 canisters of high-level waste glass and about 8,500 containers of low-activity waste glass. However, based on the vitrification plant's expected operating efficiency, the treatment percentages are expected to be higher.
If we were to do nothing and not retrieve and treat the tank waste, within 20 years you would start to see impacts in the groundwater right beneath the tanks, from the failing tanks and from the waste leaking from the tanks.
40 years of plutonium production for national defense created the Hanford tank waste problem, the largest environmental cleanup challenge in the country. And it will take significant time and funding to solve this problem. We can't afford to delay this cleanup. We must make cleanup of the Hanford tank waste a national priority to protect the Columbia River, the surrounding communities, and the economy of the Northwest. Let's all work together to make this project a success.
One thing I don't like about the video is that it gives the impression that these things are happening and it's going to be done. Well, these things are planned, and the current budget, like I mentioned earlier, does not allow it to get done. They will have to shut down the operations of building transfer systems and building treatment plants under the current funding scenarios that's been proposed by the government. One of the political things that I like to raise is the and all political parties, I think, do this to some degree, trying to maintain and gain support for what they're proposing. But the current administration is doing something that, since I've been around, hampered and getting exposed to the political process for about 10 years, and the old-timers that tell me that they've never seen anything as confining or restricting as the current process that's underway. Essentially, under the fiscal year 2002 budget that is due out by the end of September, Congress is debating over this summer, the Office of River Protection, my customer, if you will, we are not allowed to talk publicly, and so I'm not representing the Department of Energy, and I'm not speaking for them, but I have information that tells me that there are serious impacts, like I've said, based on the current budget. The administration has basically told the gentleman that you heard, he's the manager for the Office of River Protection, basically have told him he would be sent to Siberia of the Department of Energy, whatever that might be. Some people think that's Hanford already, but he would be sent. He would be sent or lose his job if he spills the beans about what the impacts will be to the project and to cleanup at the Hanford site, particularly to this tank project. The public relations spin that's coming out of Washington, D.C. is that, hey, we have increased your budget. I think it's $65 million. Our budget this past year was over $800 million. To be able to build a major treatment facility and to be able to do that requires extensive capital investment. We needed, and we've told the Department of Energy and the administration, we need about $400 million more. They don't mention that when they put out their press releases that we're supporting Hanford and we think the tank project is one of the top priorities in the Department of Energy, because we sent them 65. It's only, you know, roughly 350 short, but we've sent them 65 million more. And that will basically kill the project and put us, if we have enough funding, into a babysitting mode and or building the temporary storage again for the Hanford site. That is some of the politics going on, trying to get and garner the political priorities that one administration might have versus something that this region publicly, through meetings and statements, the governor of the state of Washington, Governor Locke, has basically described the Hanford tanks as an underground Chernobyl waiting to happen. The state attorney general and the governor have contacted Secretary Abrams, the Secretary of Energy, as well as the administration, to basically inform them that they are out of compliance and a major date will be missed to start construction on the treatment facility July 31st. My suspicion is that sooner than 2 weeks after that date, the state of Washington may sue the federal government to say that you are out of compliance, you need to move forward with this. The problem with that is then you have lawyers spending money in law room and courtrooms as opposed to the workers in the field cleaning up the environmental mess. So it's a real strained political poker game going on right now between this region and those back in Washington, D.C. about how far can you go. The state of Washington and the state of Oregon, for that matter, I think are extremely, extremely frustrated, and rightfully so. Oregon has a lot at stake too, because the Columbia River, as many of you may know already, basically is the border between the state of Washington and the state of Oregon. They also are at risk of having serious environmental impacts if tanks leak and flows of contamination continue to reach the groundwater and ultimately the Columbia River flowing down to the Portland area. And the sightseeing places in between. Please, if there's questions, otherwise I'll give you some more background.
Yeah, if this plant is built, would it be only for use with Hanford waste, or is there the possibility of bringing in waste from all over the country?
See, that is an interesting political chip that's being bartered about. For example, they're talking to build the treatment plant. It's about $4+ billion to build a Hanford treatment plant. Idaho needs a treatment plant or a place to send their waste to be treated. It's in a powder form, but it needs to go to a national repository, and the national repository state of admission would be in a glass form. And so you'd have to alter our treatment plant to accommodate their waste, but it could be done. So to save maybe a few million dollars in Idaho, ultimately some in 30, 40 years, perhaps you send it to the Washington plant, the Hanford plant. That's a possibility. The implications there politically is that a lot of people don't even want it shipped. I mean, a lot of people are concerned about having that stuff on their highways going down their streets and through their neighborhoods. So you have a major political public discussion that hasn't really been done. Decisions are being made when there are national environmental impact studies that continue to be put on hold or delayed. There's a solid waste environmental impact statement that has been delayed at least a year or two, and looks like it might be delayed another year or two. At the same time, low-level waste and other waste forms are being shipped around the country and or particularly to Hanford without necessarily going through a formal public process to verify this is what the general public thinks is the right way to disposition these materials. Another thing about the video that I'd be critical of is that they talk about this vitrification or glass making process as proven and safe. Well, whenever you're dealing with high level radioactive waste, I don't care what industry it is, whether it's petroleum industry or any other major treatment facility, there's always the risk of accident. And safety is obviously a critical issue and needs to be in play. But to imply that everything's going to be hunky-dory once a treatment plant is built, assuming we ever get one, is, I think, a little misleading. It is a high-risk business. There's just no question about that. So that needs to be put in perspective. Yes.
I lived in California not more than a week after our first rolling blackout.
Mm-hmm.
We began hearing on new talk about building new nuclear plants.
Correct.
Skeptic that I am, I'm thinking, is this gerrymandered by, is that what the rolling blackouts are all about, or what? Have you been manipulated a bit to get new nuclear power plants going, or?
Well, I'm not that close to the inside on whether or not that's the policy or not, but you do have leaders in power from the energy business. And whether it's oil or otherwise. And I know that the administration, through a study that was conducted by Vice President Cheney, basically looked at and recommended that nuclear energy be put on as a higher priority for energy resource. Yes.
Without taking away your focus here, I'm wondering if you could put a little wider parameter on our issue. What are we looking at below? I can understand now why the United States has been so reluctant to help with the obviously serious cleanup need in the former Soviet Union, for instance. But what does all this mean, even beyond Washington, Idaho, and the United States?
Well,
help us to feel a lot worse.
Yeah, I'm trying not to go there too far. I want to leave some sense of hope and or sense of urgency on your hearts, to be honest with you, in terms of what might be able to be done. And or, in general, what kind of legacy we've received, a legacy in our generation. We're talking generations upon generations that would be recipients in this next decade, if you will, next century, if you will. What do we want our children's children to be left with as it continues to get more expensive? Hanford probably is identified as probably the most messed up place, environmental mess, in at least the Western Hemisphere. Russia, the former Soviet Union, I don't think we've understood completely the level, but I think they beat us on that one. They've got some real major messes there. In fact, I am a contractor, I don't necessarily represent the government officially in any formal way, but I work for them and I have been allowed to be a spokesperson at times. The company that I work for is Battelle. They run the Pacific Northwest National Lab that's located in Hanford. Battelle is headquartered in Columbus, Ohio. They Battelle, have been working through the federal government to provide technology cleanup and or more economic diversification for the major nuclear industries or cities that were built in the former Soviet Union. You're looking at PhD scientists running all over the place looking for work and can't find it. They're getting better offers from terrorists and other people to provide elite materials of some form to them for whatever purposes. And so the government policy is trying to help them find other ways of making a living, finding an honest way to pull themselves out of basically an economic collapse situation in terms of the nuclear world that they were in. But there is major, you know, major environmental problems there. At the same time, for example, Russia and this government is helping Russia and other places build nuclear power plants because of their need for energy. Again, producing more waste of some form or fashion in India, China, Russia, all around, you know, Japan, other places all around that extremely reliant upon nuclear energy or want to become. There isn't the same stigma that this country has toward nuclear power. France, for example, and England have vitrification facilities. They are turning their nuclear-generated fuel or waste, their waste into glass material. The scale of theirs is incredibly less than ours in terms of what we're talking. A lot of those companies that have been running those industries over there in, say, France and England have been bidding and or part of the teams that are at Hanford or other UE sites around the country and have some level of expertise. But again, unfortunately, every major site was working pretty much in a sense of secrecy and or by itself. So each of them have their own sense of their own recipe for a witch's brew. And so one recipe to turn something into glass in, say, South Carolina, that recipe won't work to turn it to glass in Hanford. So there's a lot of experimentation. There's a lot of unknowns that they have in terms of actually being able to treat the waste. So the technology is identified, proven, it's pushing it, especially at this scale. We really don't know what to do. There's been other alternatives looked at besides making glass, which is probably the longest term, and those that regulators and our regional environmentalists have told us that they think is the best alternative, even though it's on the edge of probably being the most expensive. Some scientific studies have said that you can just leave it in place and just cap off the tanks and just allow nature to run its course and allow it to ebb slowly into the environment, and that over time and decay it wouldn't be that bad, and dilution is the solution. The Columbia River will fix the problem once it hits it in 50 years, 20 years, or 100 years, whatever the situation might be. So that's a possibility. Another thought is pouring rock and gravel into the tanks. A lot of the material as it's settling in there and the hazardous chemicals and so forth solidify. You saw some pictures where basically it's like a concrete material. And to go in there and to dilute it and break it out and retrieve it, you have to add a lot of volume of water to it to be able to make it mobile again. To do that, again, you generate and create a large volume of waste. Have to evaporate it down and try to treat it, but it's still dealing with situations where the technology now is like taking a hose and basically watering it down there. The mechanical arm operating that hose goes off. In the older tanks, you might blow a hole right through the wall of a tank. That's one of the concerns that they have. So there's a lot of uncertainties about how you do this. They're experimenting and going through, working with the state of Washington, of developing technologies that would be delayed under the current budget, and but we can't tell anybody that. That's my general understanding of what the global situation is. I mean, there is needs there. This technology could be used in other places. This technology would help hopefully close some of the loop. A major part of the bucket of waste is in our backyard here in southeastern Washington.
Glass. Is this merely a storage process? Converting it into glass? Or is there any use for the glass?
Good question. I'm not aware of any way that they could mine this glass other than, you know, if the energy crisis gets too bad, I suppose they could put it little chips of it, chips of it around and try to heat homes or something. No, there isn't any way. That's one thing that some people would like to do. Some scientists would say, "Hey, we've got a gold mine here in this waste, so that we can go in there and extrapolate different sorts of isotopes for cancer research. We can pull out different sorts of minerals and mine those minerals out of the waste through some sort of pre-treatment filtration system, and be able to get all this stuff basically at cost from the government because they're trying to get rid of it so we can reduce the volume. So there is that avenue of thinking that you can mine it. Because of the radioactivity and dealing with it and the hazards associated with mining it in that form, it's difficult. Once you put it in a glass, it's pretty much locked up, and I'm not aware of any other use that you can use for it once it's stored like that. But again, that's deemed as probably the most longest term, and we're talking tens of thousands of years, of putting it in at least a safer form as if they get the recipe right. Putting it in as safe a form as possible for at least a few generations to come. I guess some questions I'd like to toss out there for folks would be, who's ultimately going to be responsible for following up with this? Is it the politicians? Is it the decision of the public to tell the politicians? And then what role should we play to do that? Again, another question, some people think that we could just wait another 10 or 20 years and we'll find that magic pill and be able to cheaply save billions of dollars, have the best anti-ballistic missile systems in the world, or maybe not, but at least we would have tried and maybe find a cheaper way in 10, 20, 30 years from now to be able to treat this waste before most of it leaks into the environment. Is that an acceptable thing? Where should the priority be? And perhaps at Holy Village and preaching to the choir a little bit about what the answers might be. But to me, what's missing is the availability or the access to the general public. Part of my job is trying to find ways to do that, so that's why when I'm up here on vacation, I like to take an opportunity to share what I know about a general cleanup project associated with the Department of Energy, specifically Hanford, because I think people don't understand necessarily what the ramifications are, at least what the current ramifications are and the processes that are underway.
Is the general public capable of understanding the issues? I mean, to say the general public ought to, but on what basis can we assume they have the capacity to make an intelligent decision?
And how much information and how timely does that information need to be so that they can provide that input in a sequential way so that the decision makers have that information before they have to make a decision tomorrow on an issue that came up yesterday? Exactly. I mean, that is an ultimate challenge, and one of the frustrating parts is a public involvement person who wants the public and or others to be involved in that process and believe in that philosophy. The challenge that we deal with is ultimately the decision makers are your state elected officials to your federal congressional officials and the administration. Congress ultimately controls the purse strings. The federal and state laws basically exempt Congress from being sued. It's essentially the states and or the general administration. But Congress has ultimately the decision on what the priority should be. A lot of people would say Hanford has been basically milking the federal government for at least $1 billion a year for the last 50 years. It's time for them to get off the dole and just deal with it and cut the funding down to $500 million or $200, $300 million and just let them babysit the place. Put a fence up. The current administration, this is one of the ironies of watching the political process, is that the same day the president's budget was introduced for public dissemination, a paper from a conservative think tank was issued that basically said, you know, the environmental management, U.S. Department of Energy in general, and the government overall is very wasteful with how it uses and spends its money. And Hanford and other places were identified for taking millions and billions of dollars over the years and having little to show for it. Well, if you wanted to, I could go and tell you a lot of specific things that have been done that have helped in terms of cleanup at Hanford. It hasn't stopped the main biggest environmental threats and were the most expensive ones, but they have been band-aiding and or fixing some problems out there. And we're on process to do that. the funding cuts and the proposal from this think tank is that basically it would be less dangerous to the environment in the long run and or more financially advantageous to the taxpayers to put a fence around these kind of places and just walk away and leave it alone. That's literally what one report says. So that is kind of the challenge that the general public, can you understand this? There's enough PR coming from one side and the other and everybody's like scratching their heads trying to figure what's real. I'd encourage you, whether I have seen environmentalists misuse and abuse facts and figures, I've seen federal and state representatives use and misuse figures. I'm trying to be as honest as I can with the information that I have in front of me. Basically melding information that I've heard from both sides to try to give you some sort of balance of where people are at.
Have you thought about, since your problem is voter education, the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho getting together with the education departments in their state and at the high school level in the science classes, you know, branching out into every single high school in those three states and saying, here's the problem. You know, I can't promise you what the solution is, but this is something you folks need.
This is an issue. You should be aware of it. And unfortunately, I don't have an answer for you, but you, as a citizen, should be entitled to that. Yes, we have thought of some of those things. I have personally gone to community colleges and high schools and different programs and met with, taking my colleagues from the state of Washington and Oregon, and so I'm just not looking like a Department of Energy person out there speaking the government speak, but actually having them give a third-party perspective. We've done some of that. The issue, again, is resources.
Sure.
The project that I'm matrixed to support for communications, there's two or three of us. I'm basically the public involvement person for an $800 million to $1 billion project. And there's a lot of schools out there.
Sure.
There's a lot of places to cover.
And that would be something more to come if the states are concerned. The state should be working possibly towards.
And
the block should be able to say, hey, this is an issue I'm concerned about. Let me educate my voters.
Yeah. And we've been doing that. We've been working with the state of Washington to try to develop videos, something like this, in terms of getting it into the teachers and into their classrooms and part of their curriculum to understand what this Hanford thing is all about. Part of the challenge that I deal with is the credibility issue. Department of Energy, about 600-person focus group survey that was done several years ago by University over in New York. It wasn't New York University, it was Columbia University, I believe, ironically. And they basically identified that of all the federal agencies that exist out there, the Department of Energy has the lowest amount of credibility of any of them, by far. There have been so many promises and misrepresentations of the information and facts, and it's just phenomenal. The only thing with less credibility are the scum-sucking contractors that work for the Department of Energy, such as myself. So we carry quite a baggage when we walk into a room and say, hey, we're from the government, we're representing the government, we're here to help. I mean, it flies over real far. Again, you know, my proposal generally is that, hey, if I'm going to go out and talk to somebody, I want to bring in a regulator, I want to bring in a stakeholder, I want to bring in somebody who is viewed as somebody who's more objective than I or the agency that I represent would be. So that's always a challenge. And then getting that information out so that it is not looked as public relations, PR. There is a strong mentality, although Congress created the Office of Bird Protection 2 years ago and broke it out of basically literally the center of the Hanford site and said, this legislation, Hanford is a mess. We need to have one name recognition of what we're trying to do. We're trying to protect the Columbia River Office of Bird Protection. And two, you need to have local autonomy and authority to make decisions. And for the gentleman on the video is the current manager. The last one got fired because he was bucking the system and trying to follow the letter of the law. He got fired a year ago. The last 6 to 8 months has been very challenging for me as well as personally for him, because he's been on the cusp of pushing how far he can be more politically correct his predecessor, but he's doing a lot more of the back channel work that's required to keep people informed about some issues in at least the politically high level places. But it's a constant challenge, that. More questions, issues? This general environmental kind of theme is going to be something that's going to be talked about in a forum on Thursday evening. I'd like to see how more the youth and other people of all ages and spectrums might be involved in how we, as a community, larger than what we are today at Holden, but you know, nationally and not globally, are going to be looking at these kind of issues because they will be affecting us globally ultimately in the, if their lives just run their course. So.
I have a statement to make.
Sure,
I think
sure.
that, you know, if you take that apple theme, that's what brings it into my home back in Minnesota where I care about it. You know, where when I leave Washington State, I won't remember Hanford.
Yeah.
But if it's in my apple that I pick up at the grocery store, you know, then it brings it home to me. And then the whole country can get involved. And you were saying, how can you get people connected to this and realize that this needs to be paid, have some attention paid to? And I don't know, who could orchestrate a big PR thing like that?
The government's really not good and I'm doing that if it's something that they don't necessarily want to prioritize. Qualify that a little bit. But you're right, it has to be a national issue to be able to find the commitment to fund this over the 30, 40 years at the, you know, at least $1 billion a year. The situation is, and right now, the tactic that's being taken right now is that it's not just Hanford asking the administration for a plus up of $300 to $400 million, but what we're doing, the states are unifying with those states with environmental cleanup sites, Department of Energy sites are unifying and basically saying the whole environmental budget got cut by $1 billion. It needs to be plussed up by at least $1 billion, and if not more, to meet its regulatory compliant requirements. You need to do that. So you've got, you just don't have, say, from the state of Washington, two Democratic senators and a Democratic governor asking the Republican administration for a major plus up in its budget when he's trying to cut it. You've got Republican and Democrats around the country basically saying environmentally, this should be a priority. And so it needs to be a nationally recognized, and those kind of analogies that fit for people, please throw them my way, and we'll use them as much as we can to try to make sure that people understand and can personalize and relate to that, to what this means. So, I appreciate your patience and your questions.
Thank you.